hear people talking bad about the way we have to live here in this country. Harping on wars we fight, griping about the way things ought to be. And I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down my country, man, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting in the dark and dying. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. You're running down my country. And you're walking on right beside me. I read about some squirrely guy who claims he just don't believe in fight. And I wonder just how long the rest of us can count on being free. They live on milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. When they're running down my country horse, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting in the fog and dusty. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you run down my country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting in the fog and dark key. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you run down my country, man, you're walking on right beside me.
Yes, when you run down my country, you're walking down the fighting side of me. And that's the name of this program here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Well, not everything that comes from the West is necessarily good. And I've got to say, the campaign for same-sex marriage has reached Taiwan. Now, Taiwan is a Western-oriented country, it used to be called Nationalist China. These were the anti-communists who fled the communist revolution in 1949 and set up a government in exile on the island of Taiwan. Now, while Red China languished for years and years and years in dreadful poverty and destruction of human rights, etc., Taiwan thrived economically, even though it faced, and in fact today still does face, military threats from communist China. Anyway, it's sad to see them approving same-sex marriage. It's apparently the only country in the Far East that does. Not Japan, not Korea, not Taiwan, not Vietnam. Taiwan's legislature voted on Friday to legalize same-sex marriage, a first in Asia and a boost for the LGBT rights activists. Lawmakers pressured by LGBT groups as well as by church organizations opposed to the move approved most of the government's sponsored bill that recognizes same-sex marriages and gives couples many of the rights of marriages, including the right to have to deal with child custody.
And that, of course, is the problem. It is not, whatever else it might be, a same-sex relationship is not a marriage. That's right. I mean, it just is not a marriage. Canada is going to have a big event June 18th, at the Toronto Convention Center. So this is a big fundraiser, I believe, for an outfit called the Friends of the Simon Wiesenthal Center. Really pretty pathetic. As you're urged to register today, Friends of the Simon Wiesenthal Center requests the pleasure of your company. The 2019 Spirit of Hope benefit will be held on Tuesday the 19th of, the 18th, this is a big fundraising event. And guess who's going to be shilling for the, it's a big dinner, of course. Reception at 5, dinner and program. The dinner chairman is Paul Bronfman of the famous Bronfman bootlegging family. I'm not saying he's a bootlegger, but his grandfather was. Gerald W. Schwartz, he's chairman of Onyx Corporation, a big Jewish financier in Canada. And who is going to be the special guest of honor to bring in a crowd? Well, none other than former U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Nikki Haley. And she'll be interviewed by David Axelrod, Master of Ceremonies is Lara Logan, who is the Chief Foreign Affairs Correspondent for CBS and 60 Minutes. And it's being held at the Toronto Convention Center, which is a very, very prestigious and expensive place. Well, how much is this going to cost? Well, as a friend and sponsor, it's only $360. And the Friends of the Simon Wiesenthal Center, despite the fact that it's a clearly partisan lobbying group, actually is entitled to give tax credits. So for $360, you get a dinner ticket. For $500, you become a patron sponsor. That includes one dinner ticket and recognition of the digital program book. For $1,000, you get two tickets. For $2,500, you become a Ruby sponsor. That includes two dinners, program seats, recognition of the digital program, and paid parking. And it goes all the way up to $100,000, includes two first-tier tables at the center court, VIP meet and greet with the feature speakers, marketing exposure and advertisements, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Well, this is a big fundraiser. Now, what really bothers me about this is who's shilling for them, and that's Nikki Haley. Now, Nikki Haley, although she was fairly strong as UN ambassador in standing up to some of the tyrannical states of the world, when she was governor of South Carolina, she signally betrayed white people. Remember what happened when the accused Dylann Roof shot up that Negro church in Charleston about 3-4 years back? That was then, I think he was posed in some picture online with a Confederate flag. Well, that set off an orgy, absolute orgy of attacks on the Confederate flag. In fact, Nikki Haley got rid of the Confederate flag, which was as part of the flag of the state of South Carolina. And she was one of the many who started using this excuse, the excuse of one man who represented nobody but himself, committing this act, it was almost as if, some people say that it was actually programmed that way. I don't know, but let's say this is the way it turned out. And and Nikki Haley was very much part of that, and she made it quite clear that she was being an opponent of Donald Trump. So although he went ahead and appointed her to the to be ambassador to the United Nations, but she made it quite clear that she was an opponent of his. And she was quite proud of diversity and multiculturalism. She was actually of Sikh heritage, although she allegedly is converted to Christianity. She made it quite clear when she visited India and slapped on the usual garb, you know, the Sikh woman's kind of a long dress and shawl. This was her heritage. So Nikki Haley is quite proudly of a different heritage. Now, I blame not very bright Republicans in South Carolina for having elected her. But worse than that, having elected her, they were betrayed. You know, I think it's a perfectly fair comment to say, well, why don't we elect our own? Why do we have to have other people to represent us? And to some extent, you know, this is what you get when you have other people representing you. So Nikki Haley is now off to participate in this Zionist event, and you know, it's a fundraising event for a lobby, among other things, for causes that are ours. Well, you know, not absolutely everything, to be fair, that Senator Elizabeth Warren has suggested is bad. And I think we should be open-minded on issues. And this is some of what has come out recently. This is Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. She's now known by the initials as AOC. She's also endorsed Senator Elizabeth Warren's proposal to break up the big technology companies. This is maybe one way to get a handle on the outright censorship that so many of us are suffering from outfits like Facebook, PayPal, YouTube, Twitter. These, one option would be to break these companies up. They're monopolies or virtual monopolies. They should be broken up so that there really is competition. There isn't right now. That is something that there absolutely has to be if we're going to get freedom back. And I think this is something people should agitate for a lot more than they are right now. Demand this, that we get this freedom back. And one way to do that is to break these monopolies up so that there would be more companies and thereby real competition. Another would be, and this was actually not their proposal, but another would be to insist that they be treated like public utilities, and be forced to serve all people without discrimination. You know, in other words, YouTube cannot cut you off because you're a white nationalist. Facebook, of course, is doing that right now. The white nationalists, white supremacists, they're all the same thing, according to Facebook. Well, that has to stop. And I think we should encourage this debate wherever it occurs, and not shy away from the fact that, the proposal may come from somebody we would normally not particularly like, but that shouldn't matter. I think we're going to have to become just a lot more insistent. Well, one of the really bad things that happened in the life of a controversial Canadian big businessman. At one point, he owned chains of newspapers. Conrad Black. He is a conservative. He is an intellectual. He is a writer. He is unfortunately a big supporter of the state of Israel, but on many other issues, he's actually quite good. Well, he found himself in dreadful trouble in the United States some years ago, and he ended up being sentenced to jail for over 6 years, although he could have gone for much longer, in federal prison, where he would be kept for the prison term means what it says, like 6 years would mean basically pretty close to 6 years. It might be 5 years and 10 months. Anyway, much of this is written up. President Donald Trump, I think quite rightly, pardoned Conrad Black this week as having been the victim of a miscarriage of justice. And this is an extensive column written about the Mark Stein, and this is in today's National Post. Smuggling Conrad Black over the border was always my plan B. And this is Mark Stein. The last time I saw my old boss, Conrad Black, was a week ago. It was a very Canadian occasion. And he talks a little bit about this. I'm going to skip parts of it. And there was just actually before, a day or two before Doris Day died. He says, when Miss Day died a few days later, almost all of the broadcast tributes played a snippet of Que sera, sera, whatever will be, will be. The future's not ours to see. Que sera, sera. That's a little fatalistic for my taste, he says. Nevertheless, in just a very few areas of life, the future is ours to see with piercing clarity. For example, if you attract the attention of America's federal justice system, this is a very important point. You're going down, no question. You have, quote, the right to a fair trial. But U.S. prosecutors win 99% of the cases that go to court, a success rate that would embarrass Kim Jong-un and Saddam Hussein. Indeed, the feds win 97% without ever going near court. In 2007, on the first day of Conrad Black's trial on the 12th floor of the Mies van der Rohe skyscraper that houses Chicago's dozens of federal courtrooms, I went looking for somewhere to make a discreet call on my cell phone. There were people everywhere, reporters, lawyers, spouses, curious deputy attorneys dropping in from neighboring offices, a fan of mine wanting me to autograph my Broadway book to his pal, John. Eventually, I pushed open the door and found myself in an empty courtroom. So I phoned from there in complete privacy. When others attending the trial discovered the room, I went to the empty courtroom further down the corridor. And when in turn that grew popular as a handsomely paneled telephone booth, I went to the empty courtroom upstairs or downstairs. So many courtrooms and no trials. Because when the odds of not losing are 1 in 100, who goes to court? Americans who know anything about the country's evil and depraved justice system grasp that central fact. It's only rubes who say, let the process play out, or if you haven't done anything wrong, you've got nothing to fear. For a start, by the time the process plays out, you'll be broke and scavenging from dumpsters, as Trump's fallen national security honcho Michael Flynn learned shortly before copping a plea. Second, from a prosecutorial point of view, if you haven't done anything wrong, they can still get you on misremembering to the FBI in a matter for which there's no underlying crime, as Martha Stewart discovered, or alternatively, on Robert Mueller's second favorite process crime of hanging out with too many foreigners in alleged breach of the Foreign Agents Registration Act. Yeah, the persecution of people with very serious jail time for activities that are not even crimes. And this, what's it called again? The Foreign Agents Registration Act, which Trump's aide George Papadopoulos told me Mueller had threatened him with. I met most Australian cabinet ministers of the John Howard years, so I am undoubtedly guilty on that front, even before you factor in a dinner with Jason Kenney, that's easy, former conservative immigration minister in Canada, and a bit of a chit-chat with Maxime Bernier, who's former conservative, who's founded a new populist party in Canada called the Canada People's Party. It's a corrupt system, this is the American justice system, heavily reliant on blackmail. But its crude, thuggish simplicity concentrates the mind, and thus everybody gets it. Which is why, when the dismantling of Conrad Black's business empire began 16 years ago, the rich and powerful were the first to abandon him. Whatever will be, but one thing's for certain. Conrad's screwed. He's over. Cut him loose. The U.S. government threatened to send the independent directors of Hollinger Wells notices. That's to say, a public warning that you may be on the hook for violating securities laws. The way to avoid getting a Wells notice was to testify against Lord Black at trial. And so basically, many of the directors of Conrad's Black's company, Hollinger, at the time, were essentially blackmailed into testifying against him. With the very clear message, if you don't, he could be coming after you. And people knew exactly what that meant. That would mean financial ruin. So, former Illinois Governor Jim Thompson, a former ambassador David Burke, and former vice chairman of the Royal Canadian and Canada's National Passenger Transportation, her name was Marie-Josée Kravis, meekly trooped to the witness stand to explain that although their names appeared on all the same documents as Conrad Black's did, they had no idea, as mere simple governors, ambassadors, and royal commissioners, what they were signing, and they simply skimmed the paperwork, skimmed being the agreed formulation. In McLean's magazine at the time, I described them as America's synchronized skimming team. On the day former Governor Jim Thompson's testimony, he'd been on the Harlinger Board of Directors, and he turned against Conrad Black. A staffer approached me and said the governor wondered if I was free for lunch. I replied I'd rather eat dog feces than dine with a dead husk of a nothing of a shell of a non-man who'd laid down his friend for his life. And yet, although not a synchronized skimmer myself, I too fell prey to their fatalism. As I discovered after the trial, I'd advised Lord Black to climb into the back of my pickup. I'd throw a tarp over him and drive him across the minimally guarded Plattsburgh, New Hampshire, La Patrie, Quebec border, and east to Fortune, Newfoundland, where he could take the ferry to Saint-Pierre-et-Miquelon. That's a little French island just off the Newfoundland coast, and a waiting twin prop. Now, this is sort of facetious, but nonsense, thundered Conrad. He was an innocent man, and he would be vindicated by the justice system of this great republic. I was suppressed a titter and the urge to tell him that that would support an insanity plea. And so the battle consumed vast amounts of money, and even more if you add in the cash the Fed simply stole from him, like the proceeds they confiscated from the sale of his New York apartment. It cost him also lifelong friendships, as prosecutors brought up his closest business partner, a Jew by the name of David Rattler, and his secretary, and anyone else who helped them get closer to the big fish, and threatened those in Toronto and London willing to testify on his behalf what would happen should they choose to set foot in the U.S. to appear at the trial. It's a sad fact, writes Mark Stein, that many Canadians revile Conrad Black. They loathe him for his politics and his peerage. He was made a lord in the British House of Lords. His publications, including this one, that's the Financial Post, or I should say the National Post. But even so, they ought to give him credit for the sheer strength of will required to push back against the onslaught of the last decade and a half. His ordeal ended with a Trump pardon. I confess I'd had minimal hopes of, because as the president was doubtless advised, there's nothing in it for him, that's for Trump. For the record, here's the final score. The government of the United States initially brought 17 charges. Everyone seems to ooh and awe over that. But to bring multiple charges over a single crime is in itself malodorous. Even with the Boston Marathon bomber, it wasn't enough that the guy loaded up his backpack, detonated it, and killed and maimed a bunch of people. It was also necessary to charge the surviving Sarnia brother with unlawful interference in interstate commerce, because he used a stolen credit card to withdraw $800 U.S. From an ATM. There's no question, writes Mark Stein, that the bomber is guilty of bombing. And if I had my way, he'd be dangling from a gibbet 6 weeks after. But this kind of wanker sophistry degrades the very concept of law. So why do it? Well, it's a way to force you to forego justice. And this is how the blackmail system works. You're facing 47 felonies, adding up to 397 years in jail. So you agree to a plea bargain, because otherwise you risk a jury that wants to show how Solomonic it is by acquitting you on 44 counts, but convicting you on three, enough to destroy your life. The U.S. attorney operates on the same principles as the IRA, who after the Brighton bombing taunted Mrs. Thatcher that they only had to be lucky once. She had to be lucky every time. Patrick Fitzgerald, that was one of the prosecutors, had to be lucky once. Conrad Black had to be lucky every time, and he came close. Of these 17 counts, 4, including perjury and money laundering, were abandoned before the trial, and the U.S. $400 million he was accused of looting was reduced to $60 million U.S. Of the 13 remaining counts, Conrad was acquitted on 9, leaving including racketeering and tax evasion, and found guilty of stealing, but now the figures have been reduced to just $2.9 million U.S. That's stealing it from the company of which he was the chairman of the board, Hollinger. And he didn't really steal. The surviving 4 counts were appealed to the Seventh Circuit. Unfortunately, Black had the misfortune to appear before a quasi-celebrity judge smitten by his own genius. Come the big day, alas, Richard Posner, that's the judge, was just another lazy hack who all too obviously didn't know the case and hadn't read the briefs and was blustering his way through with windy generalities about pretty naked fraud, even though pretty naked is not really a legal term, never mind an appellate argument. Conrad pressed on to the highest tribunal in the land. He went to the Supreme Court. If you follow the Kavanaugh confirmations, you'll know that America's hideously politicized Supreme Court has 4 lefties and 4 righties, and a designated swinger who's the supreme judicial arbiter of 300 plus million people. Yet on June 24th, 2010, the Supremes ruled unanimously in Conrad's favor. That's right, the left, the right, and the swinger all voted as one. The then Justice Ruth Ginsburg, Bader Ginsburg's withering opinion about Posner's anomalous judicial invention. That is, the trial judge, appeals judge, did a dreadful job, according to the Supreme Court. So his judgment was vacated, or that is, overruled. Conrad was released from prison and the 4 counts kicked back down to the Seventh Circuit for further proceeding consistent with this opinion. So instead of just letting him free, setting him free and letting him go home, there was more court torture. Of those 4 counts, 2 were overturned through gritted teeth by the Seventh Circuit, but the deeply insecure Judge Posner could not bring himself to quash the 2 remaining counts and in turn kicked them back down to the trial judge, Amy Sandee, for resentencing. Judge Amy, just as insecure, if not quite as narcissistic, decided to send Conrad back to prison for 7 months on the grounds that incarceration seemed to be doing him good. She also revised down the financial penalty to $250,000 from $2.9 million. Or, if my rough math is correct, Mark Stein writes, 0.00375 of what he'd originally been accused of looting. He'd originally been accused of theft of an immense amount of money, all of which seems to disappear as the more and more of the accusations turn out to be false. But that doesn't, even in his case, result in exoneration. Those 2 surviving counts were one of mail fraud and one of obstruction of justice, in which, as with Martha Stewart, there was no underlying crime left to obstruct. You know, if most of the crimes, alleged crimes, had been thrown out, how could he be accused of obstructing justice? or when the charges had been, he's either been acquitted in some cases, or they were tossed out by the appellate courts. That's it, other than the sole lousy count of
mail fraud,
which, says Mark Stein, is one of those stupid catch-all non-crimes designed to provide a pretext for federal jurisdiction over almost anything that tickles their fancy. For that reason, none of those Canadians who feasted on Conrad Black's comeuppance could actually explain, in the midst of their conga lines, what crime it is he actually committed. Because it isn't a crime in Canada, or England, or Australia, or Belize, or Mauritius, Singapore, St. Lucia, Tuvalu, or anywhere else in the common law world. Recently, Conrad Black was nice enough to testify on my behalf, that's on Mark Stein's behalf, in one of my own more modest legal proceedings down in the United States against a sociopathic billionaire who won't stop suing me. We worried about how much credibility an ex-con might have before an American jurist. So we figured we might as well own it in the briefs and describe the witness thus. That's Conrad Black. And there's touching irony in this. The Lord Black of Cross Harbor is an eminent Canadian historian, a member of the House of Lords, a papal knight, the former honorary colonel of the Governor General's Foot Horse, and is considered a felon. We took the position that in a system run by the likes of Prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald and Robert Miller, the last distinction, like the foregoing, is just another badge of honor. It shames only a wretched and ugly system that no American should support. The incredible shrinking crime spree of Conrad Black, after shriveling from 17 to 13 to 9 to 4 to 2 counts, and from $400 million allegedly misappropriated to $92 million to $60 million to $2.9 million to $285,000 to $150,000 in the end, has now vanished completely. Throughout an ordeal that consumed over a fifth of his life and more of his wealth, he staggered on, refusing to cut the deals that his pathetic deputy and his wretched worthless board did. That requires an amazing resilience few of us could muster. And this is really a very moving tribute by Mark Stein to Conrad Black. There is one bit of unfinished business. In a pitiful spasm of belated Canadian Me Too-ism, the then Governor General and the then Prime Minister decided, on account of those two surviving convictions, to have Conrad Black removed from the Queen's Privy Council and the Order of Canada. A man who endured what he did can surely survive having his post nominals cut off. Nevertheless, it was a craven and gutless move. It would be appropriate, I believe, says Mark Stein, for the successor regimes on Sussex Drive to reverse those actions so that the Governor General reinstate him his Order of Canada medal and that he be reappointed to the Privy Council. That is an honor given to very few people who are not, in fact, having been members of a federal cabinet. On the other hand, I'm not sure Conrad would take these baubles back. He lost almost everything, but in the end, on what mattered, he won. Last year, after CRTV, Blaze TV sued me for $10 million, lost the case, and were ordered to pay me $4 million, Conrad declared on stage that my victory was the greatest act of
accidental justice produced by the American legal system in decades. I would return the compliment, but in the case of Carmine Black, there's nothing accidental about it. He fought back against a disgusting system of unlimited power, and inch by painstaking inch, he prevailed. I was wrong to offer him a ride to St. Pierre Miquelon to my tarpaulin. His way was better. And the courage of Conrad Black in fighting for vindication really deserves a lot of praise. Well, this is Paul Fromm. You're on the fighting side of me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. I'm going to take my musical break right now. And I'm going to play a song by Heather Miles. I hope you like this. Crazy Arms. This is an old Ray Price song recorded by Heather Miles.
Crazy arms that reach to hold somebody new. Heather Miles, Crazy Arms, an old Ray Price tune. Here's another song by Heather, Walk On By. This is a Leroy Van Dyke song from the 1960s.
Just walk on by, wait on the corner.
Song from the early 1960s. This is another one with Heather in a duet with Justin Trevino. This time I know we're gonna make it.
We've survived the stormy
This time I know we're going to make it. That's Justin Trevino and Heather Miles. Here's another duet, but not a man and a woman. This time George Strait and Alan Jackson. Duet originally done by George Jones, the Possum, and Dirk Bentley, Murder on Music Row. Thinking about the...
Nobody saw him run from 16th Avenue. They never found the fingerprint or the weapon that was used. But someone killed country music, cut out its heart and soul. They got away with murder down on Music Row. The almighty dollar and lust the world I banged slowly killed tradition, and for that someone should hang. They all say not guilty, but the evidence will show that murder was committed down on Music Row. But drums and rock and roll guitars are mixed up in your face. Oh, Hank, he wouldn't have a chance on today's radio, since they committed murder down on Music Row. Said no one would buy them all, drinking cheap. Mississippi, and we hauled back to court. That murder was committed down on Music Row. He wouldn't have a chance on today's radio since they committed murder.
That's George Strait and Alan Jackson. Thoughts about what's happened to country and western music, or at least way some people feel. But I'm largely with them. I think sometimes country and western is strayed a long way from some of the greats of yesterday. Well, this is Paul Frong, and you're on the Fighting Side of Me here on RightResistanceRadio.com. Back with you again tomorrow, same time, midnight Eastern Time. The show is repeated at 8 in the morning, 4 in the afternoon. All of those are Eastern Standard Time. And I sign off tonight, as I always do, with the anthem of the real Canada, the Maple Leaf Forever.